United States of America versus Todd Wayne Pimpton.
May it please the court, Ms. Watson. What I would like to propose this morning by way of discussion on the sentencing guideline issue today is to identify three things that I'd like to talk about. One, that the Sentencing Commission's 2006 amendment interpreting and refining the interpretation of the B6 enhancement essentially reflects this court's pre-guideline case law, at least to the extent that it rejects an automatic application of the enhancement. Second, the United States' position essentially is articulating a contrary rule that would contravene not only this court's pre- and post-guideline case law, but also the 2006 amendment itself. And then lastly, it's our position that the government is asking this court to read 2K2.1 B6 in such a fashion that it would lead to a direct conflict with a fair reading of 2K2.6.
What difference does it make if it reflects the pre-guidelines case law?
What difference does...
That's your first point?
But I
think we just have to follow the 2006 amendment, that interpretation regardless.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Why did you bring that as your first point?
Because I think that the proper interpretation of the 2006 amendment is actually informed by much of the court's case law that was articulated before. I'm referring specifically to the FDEEP opinion, which talked about the notion that the presence of another felony does not automatically trigger the enhancement. What I'm suggesting, perhaps, and I was being implicit before, is that the Sentencing Commission essentially, when looking at this circuit split, adopted this court's position, at least, to the effect that the other offense, the other felony offense, did not trigger automatically the application.
So can you explain to me how this factually happened at the sentencing hearing again? Was it brought to the district court's attention that the district court was relying on a broader concept of in connection with instead of relying on the guidelines interpretation? Did someone say, Your Honor, you're not supposed to consider that. You're only supposed to consider the application notes definition.
The trial attorney filed a fairly lengthy objection and specific objection, taking specific issue with the in connection.
A written objection, but I'm saying at the hearing, I don't really see that much was done at all.
No, and the practice in that particular court is that sentencing hearings, both contested and uncontested, move fairly quickly. And I have practiced there in the district court. The practice there is to set out your objection with the majority of your specificity in writing, because sentencings move very, very quickly.
So whenever the court was erring in this fashion, assuming it was error to use a wrong interpretation of in connection, expand the definition,
right.
Nobody says, wait, stop, you're not using, that's not the correct definition anymore, that's from a case, then that's not the right definition under the guidelines.
No, actually, Judge Rod, the way it works is having filed the written objection, you go forward at sentence, the district court will ask, are there objections? You essentially are repeating the objection, but you're not objecting after imposition of the
sentence.
That doesn't happen there.
Well, that's because the lawyer chooses not to.
No, with respect, based on my years of experience, it's because the district court doesn't practice that way. I'd also like to point out to the court that in terms of broad or narrow applications of the enhancement, the commission itself has identified that it knows the difference. The language that speaks to the fact that in a drug trafficking case, that the enhancement always applies, guns being the tools of the drug trade, explicitly shows that the commission understands where the broad application is appropriate. But in those situations outside, say, the drug trafficking universe, if you will, that's where the more narrow application applies. And that's certainly where we are today.
Now, so you need to convince us first that there is a difference between the definition that was used and the correct definition so that you can be under a de novo review.
The definition that was used before, it was
the definition that was used in this case as opposed to the correct definition.
Yes, and I said before, I meant below. What the district court did below that was rather intriguing and certainly, I think, error, was not only in applying the enhancement, but also saying that the body armor essentially facilitated the gun offense. Now, in fairness, the United States has come forward and said, no, that's not the correct application. But I think that the record that you have in front of you will show that the district court was, with respect, was out of there in terms of the correct application, not only for the reasons we're saying, but they were also looking backwards. The definition that's in effect, says to look in connection with, look for actual facilitation. Now, of course, the government's going to tell you potential to facilitate, but potential to facilitate, and I'm moving into my second point now, the notion of potential to facilitate, if you focus broadly on that language, you essentially swallow the in connection with language, because I can't imagine anyone not being able to argue that the presence of a gun might have a theoretical potential to exacerbate a situation. Even people who aren't felons that have guns, theoretically, at least conceivably, are more dangerous than someone who doesn't have a gun.
Okay, and you're not supposed to use make more dangerous at all.
No, I don't think so. I think that's where the commission, when I said that the commission's amendment took part of this court's pre-2006 case law in terms of the...
In the Villegas case, using the make more dangerous.
Yes.
And you're not supposed to use that at all. But my problem is, I'm trying to see whether we're in de novo or whether we're in clear error here, because if they use the right standard and you're just saying, well, it couldn't facilitate the body armor, didn't facilitate the body armor, you have a much tougher row to hoe. But if the court used the wrong standard, you know, all bets are off, and we would have to encourage the court to use the wrong standard unless the government can show the error was harmless.
Sure.
And it's, you're not, can you clearly go through that for us?
As we'd set out in the briefing, the facts below are not in dispute. We know what happened. We're talking about the interpretation of the guideline provisions and their application. Both the interpretation and the application are afforded de novo review, and the authorities are cited in the briefing. So I understand why the government would run to clear error, and if we were in clear error land, I would almost hear the trapdoor gears beginning to grind. But this is not clear error land. This is de novo review. This refers specifically, everything that was raised below, specifically refers not only to interpretation, but also to the extent of the application, if you will, what the guideline would encompass.
Well, the application. If the court found that the body armor was facilitated by the gun, as a factual matter, it would be clear error if the court found that. And you can argue on this record that it's possible the court did find that.
If a sentencing court were to make that finding and were there evidence to support that, it would be a closer call. But with respect, I have to disagree with you, because even were the court to have made that finding, the application would still trigger the more generous review standard, generous for us, review standard, the de novo review.
So you don't, there's no disagreement as to the facts. It's just as how the judge applied the law to the facts that
we
have.
The interpretation and the application, yes. The individual was stopped, a gun was found in the trunk, the gun was sitting on top of body armor. That's not a dispute. It's okay. Plain as day.
What's your best case that it can't be potential facilitation, that it has to be actual facilitation?
Well, I think that certainly this is this was a possession case. I think Jeffries informs the court's decision. It's certainly one of the best cases. I point out that again, potential to facilitate, essentially, to our mind at least, writes out the in connection language with. We think that potential to facilitate would refer to, say, a situation like this. A would-be bank robber on his or her way to rob the bank, stopped by the police for whatever reason, routine traffic stop, perhaps not unlike this case. A subsequent search ensues, and the authorities find a note or a mask or something like this, instructions where to go to a bank, and there's a gun. The gun there, I think, would certainly have had the potential to facilitate the bank robbery. I don't think that's particularly remarkable. And that's the type of scenario I think the potential refers to. I don't think it refers to a universe of circumstances where any gun might do any harm. This is a possession, the body armor, this is simply possession, just like the Jeffries case, possession of the crack cocaine that was found in the car where the gun was located. This does not involve use, and that immediately goes into the third point that I'd wanted to discuss, and that's the 2K2.6 provision, which talks about had an individual been convicted of body armor, that you wouldn't receive this same four-level enhancement because the body armor hadn't been used. And one point that I definitely want to drive home is this. Let's say in this particular case that Mr. Pimpton had pleaded to the body armor offense and not the felon in possession offense. He wouldn't be getting the four-level enhancement, even though the same conduct, conduct is at issue. And, of course, the underlying theory supporting the guidelines.
Well, that's what his lawyer decided to do.
The sentencing guidelines instruct district courts to look at all the behavior, all the conduct below. And so what the government would be saying to you is you can look at behavior in this context triggers the four level. Same behavior in that context, the other count of conviction, does not. I'm not aware of circumstances where that would arise. I understand that the individual might have pleaded to one and not the other, but all that does is illustrate the nature of the error. The four-level enhancement was improperly applied here. It would not, and certainly the commission's aware of this. They use language in 2K2.6, specifically talking about the fact that body armor, in order to garner the enhancement, would require use. There's no use here. There is no activity. The armor was possessed. It was not used. The gun did not facilitate anything here. The government's argument, as we read it, essentially is to say, we understand that the commission has amended the guideline in 2006 to provide this clarifying information, and even though the information would seem to be more restrictive, we want a broad application. And we think that that's simply incorrect, for the reasons that were set out for deep for the amendment, but certainly afterwards. And again, we point to Jeffries.
There's some language in the Coleman case that troubles me. It says, in determining whether a guideline enhancement applies, the district court is allowed to draw such reasonable inferences from the facts, and these inferences are fact-finding reviewed for clear error. Which seems to be what we have here, that the court made some inferences from the facts that there was that the guideline applied and that there were there that one facilitated the other. How do we?
Well, I think that
apply
I,
that.
I think that
or inferences, fact findings reviewed for clear error.
Well, I would think they would have to be. I mean, we're talking about a sentencing, we're talking about a low evidentiary standard, and certainly inferences are permissible. In this particular case, Judge Prado, what's I think most alarming or certainly striking is that the district court's inferences, to the extent that it actually drew inferences as opposed to simply applying the guideline, was inferring that the armor facilitated the gun offense and said so. It concluded as much. I don't know what inferences actually might have been relying on. They certainly weren't presented.
The inference is that they are likely used together.
Excuse me? I'm sorry, Judge Ruby.
They will likely be used together. Here are two illegal items, one lying on the other in a trunk. Couldn't a reasonable judge infer that those two items went together because they would be used together?
No, at least on this record, no, I don't think so. I don't think so at all, just like I don't think, for example, in the Jeffries case where there was crack cocaine in the car and there was a gun found in the car, and this court and other courts throughout the land have said for decades now that guns are tools of the drug trade. This court, Judge Haynes speaking through this court, said no. Under the heightened standard that's set out in the 2006 amendment, and I believe that was the court's word, the heightened facilitation standard, you could not make that that conclusion. So
why can't you make that conclusion now? Why couldn't this district court make this? You've gotten the same question from all three of us in different iterations, and you've said no, and you said, well, because it didn't happen in Jeffries. Do you have any other answer? The question is common sense. These things go together. Couldn't the district court have found that they facilitated one another, and therefore we would have to use the deferential review standard, and why isn't that a reasonable inference? And we still haven't had an answer to that question.
Well, and
other than no.
Well, and I'm going to say no again, just to make sure that I am consistent, if nothing else. I don't think it was a reasonable inference in this case. I think that it's fine for district court, sentencing courts, to make inferences. But the inferences that were being drawn below were going backwards. They were suggesting that, as I was trying to explain moments ago, suggesting that the body armor facilitates the gun offense. That's what the district court said. And, of course, the government's disavowing that, and I understand why, and I would also. But that's where the district court was drawing where it was going. And we know this because that's what the court said. All right, and so my point simply being, do I think that inferences can be drawn? Certainly, inferences can be drawn in a sentencing. But in this particular case, the court, I see that my time is drawing to a close. I'll just say the court was aware, had been made aware of the challenge to the enhancement, had been made aware of what the reason, why the enhancement was incorrectly applied, and the court simply casually, perhaps, said, no, I think it's going to apply, and I think it relates backwards. And we think that that was reversible error under a de novo standard. Thank you.
Ms. Watson.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Delaney Watson. I'm representing the government. The district court here made two findings. It made a finding that the firearm facilitated the possession of the body armor, and it also made a finding that the firearm made the possession of the body armor more dangerous. And because it made both of those findings, the court can rely on simply the facilitation finding.
Do you disavow the made more dangerous? You recognize that was error.
I'm not sure that that's error, Your Honor. And the reason that I spent a lot of time in my brief discussing this, even though I think you have to look at the context in which the Sentencing Commission made that change. And it made that change specifically directed toward a circuit split. And it says it made it specifically directed to a circuit split. And even the Fourth Circuit, like the Fifth Circuit, had the language prior that talked about more dangerous and continues to use that language even after the amendment, as late as a case that I cited, I think it was in 2012, in which they still rely on the notion that, because the whole basis for the guideline in the beginning was the fact that it makes everything more dangerous.
Well, and that's so I'm just not so willing. Broad. And the court commission has clarified to say it's facilitate. It hasn't brought along the made more dangerous. If you were hoping that you would be affirmed one day in the district court, you would not argue to a district court the made more dangerous theory these days, would you?
Personally, I probably would not have.
Because it's a risk that it is still valid.
There is a risk that it's still valid, the reason I'm certainly glad that the district that we argued both.
Do we need to clarify that in this case, whether that's still valid or not?
Yes, Your Honor, you do need to clarify that.
And we could provide a service to the bar by doing so?
Yes, ma'am, you can. I would also say that in the record, the defense attorney did say to the district court that the court shouldn't base it on the made more dangerous definition. Okay. And so there was an objection or some discussion about that. But as I said, the court doesn't have to go to that issue at all because the district court here relied on both. It relied on the facilitation as well as the made more dangerous language.
Explain how the facilitation works here.
The facilitation works here because we're not relying simply on proximity, but actually the proximity of where the items are located. The gun and the body armor are in the trunk of a vehicle together. which takes it far beyond simply one being in one place, one being in the other, or even them being at home.
But there is some common sense problem with the case. How, you know, there's we were arguing common mm-hmm. sense the other way. They're together and they go together.
Right.
But how does the possession of a firearm actually facilitate possession of body armor?
Well, I think it facilitates because there's some emboldening that's there. Body armor is actually a defensive item. But once you add the firearm to it, I think that it takes on more and I'm going to sort of stray into the dangerous language. But certainly, I believe that those two are mutually facilitating, the firearm and the body armor. I mean, I think there's some idea of mutually facilitating.
Well, it's easier to say how the body armor could facilitate the firing of a gun because you'd be less likely to be afraid you'd get shot back.
Yes.
But possession of the body armor, it's not stealing the body armor. It's not doing something. Having a firearm doesn't make it easier to possess something.
But I don't think that we should read the language of facilitating that narrowly. I mean, the Sentencing Commission, when it talks about facilitation and where it got the language from, it got it from the Supreme Court case Smith. And in that case, the Supreme Court found that a defendant who bartered the firearm for drugs violated 924C. And so it did not use the definition of facilitate in the sense of it made the offense more easier, made it more easier.
And what do you do with Jeffries?
Well, Jeffries is an easy case for the government to distinguish. Jeffries involved, first of all, the Sentencing Commission has specifically said that drug possession and a firearm require something more. Proximity isn't enough. You've got a small piece of rock cocaine located on the floorboard in the back seat of the car. It's not even clear that this defendant actually even possessed it. But there's no reason or no way that the court could see how the possession of that firearm in any way facilitated the possession of a small piece of crack cocaine. Body armor is significantly different from a small piece of crack cocaine, which when consumed disappears. Body armor, when worn, creates a problem. And when you add a body armor with a firearm, with a felon, you're talking about at that point something that becomes an emboldening, and it may be mutually emboldening, but certainly there's something much more there than a small piece of crack cocaine in the backseat of a vehicle.
Should we remand this case so that the court can apply the correct standard and let the court determine whether or not it facilitated?
No, Your Honor, because the court made both findings. It didn't make just one finding. It made a finding that it facilitated. And it based that on the argument that the prosecutor made, that these two things go hand in hand. And we don't have to look far in the news to see that.
But hand in hand is not enough. Hand in hand is not enough for facilitate.
That's if you use a very narrow definition
of
facilitate. Yeah, I don't
assume arguendo that hand in hand is not enough. It actually has to make it easier to use the other item, make it easier to accomplish the criminal goal of the other activity, possessing the body armor.
But if the court wants me to use that very narrow definition, it would be difficult for me to.
You can't win under that.
I can't win under that.
I don't need to send it back. You just lose under that.
If you're going to use that narrow definition of facilitate, the government would lose.
Okay.
But
it's not just like salt and pepper go together. Body armor it's not just go together. They have to facilitate means help you accomplish the end of something.
If the court applies that very narrow definition. But if you look at what the Sentencing Commission said, it's relying on Smith. And Smith has a very broad definition of facilitate, not one that is that narrow. And so I think the if the court relies on that narrow a definition, then the government would have a problem getting asking this court
and
to
I
affirm.
And I appreciate your candor with the court. Thank you.
Yes. Now, would I also like to make one point about 2K2.6? I don't think that adds any to the appellant's argument. That guideline is for a violation of 18 U.S.C. 931, possession of body armor by a violent felon. And it actually requires the use of the body armor. And so therefore, and without that, every defendant who was guilty, if it didn't have the use but had the possession and use language that 2K2.1 has, then every defendant guilty of that would actually get the enhancement. And because it uses the language use as opposed to potential use or possession, and also the definition of facilitation is even different in 2K2.1. And it talks about the potential to facilitate. And that also, I think, is a difference in terms of the facilitation here, because it does talk about, the definition says potential to facilitate. So that has to be something more than a narrow, simple, narrow definition of facilitate. And we believe that body armor, first of all, the body armor by itself is a defensive, is wholly defensive. But when a firearm is added to that, and that's the whole point, when a firearm is added to the possession of that body armor, it does something different. It makes it have a potential there that it didn't have before. And so based on that and the broad language in Smith, and the standard of review, because the standard of review here should be clearly erroneous, because it's a factual finding that the court has made. Based on that, the government believes that the court should affirm in this case.
What do you do?
How important is it that they were found right next to each other?
Say I think one it's was, very important that they
say
were found.
Say one was in the back seat and one was in the trunk. Would that make a difference?
That wouldn't make that big a difference in my mind, but the fact that they were found together in the trunk just adds, I think, more weight to the district court's finding that these two things had something to do with each
if
other.
If one was back at the house, would you have sought this enhancement?
No, ma'am, we would not have, because I think it would have been impossible to show, based upon Jeffries, that in fact there was a potential to facilitate.
What do you do with opposing counsel's argument that if he would have pled to the other offense, that you couldn't have gotten the enhancement because to the body armor rather than to the gun?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we wouldn't have permitted him to plead to an offense that had a lower sentencing availability if the firearm.
Right, but what he's saying is that the whole argument is like they go together, you know. But body armor and guns go together, but you can't get the enhancement the other way because it doesn't work logically.
But that's what the argument or the comments that I was making earlier. If you look at 2K2.6, which is the guideline that he's talking about, that's the guideline that covers when a violent felon simply possesses body armor with nothing else attached to it. And so the guideline would be the base offense level, I think, is 10. Then if he uses the body armor in connection with the offense, and in that instance, the Sentencing Commission has defined use very narrowly. He has to use it to protect against fire, or he has to barter it. And it's only in those instances that it would apply. So I don't think you can really compare these two, because they're designed to get to other conduct. So say, for instance, if a violent felon had possessed had used the body armor to protect himself when fired upon by the police, then the worst he would have gotten, the most he would have gotten, is 14. But that's something very different from I'm wearing body armor and I'm firing as well. So therefore, or I have the potential to fire as well. That's a very different fact scenario that deserves a higher sentence. So you can't compare those two. And just because you wouldn't get it under 2K2.6 says nothing about whether it's applicable in this situation where there's a firearm present, and in the other one there would not be a requirement of a firearm at all. P- Plus, it has totally different language, which specifically requires use, says nothing about facilitation, says nothing about the potential facilitation, says nothing about the application when it's simply possession. The Sentencing Commission recognized that there's a significant difference when you combine a firearm with any other offense. That's totally different from where a violent felon simply possesses body armor. And only when he uses it does he get an additional bump in his sentencing guidelines. But when a felon possesses a firearm and he has that in connection with another offense, the Sentencing Commission has determined that he should receive a higher sentence. And based upon the facts here, a firearm with body armor in the back of a vehicle that the defendant is driving, the government believes that under the clearly erroneous standard that this court should affirm. If there are no other questions, thank you.
A couple of points. Proximity. The commission has explicitly addressed the notion of proximity in the commentary when it talks about the fact that in drug trafficking cases, the enhancement will always apply precisely because of the proximity, the notion that guns are tools of the drug trade. If I understand Ms. Watson correctly, perhaps what she's arguing is for the articulation of a new rule that body armor and guns enjoy the same type relationship. There's nothing on the record that suggests they do. There's certainly nothing in the case law of which I'm aware that suggests they do. I think proximity, Judge Prado, is irrelevant in this case. Certainly in Jeffries it was irrelevant, and what was portrayed as a small piece of crack cocaine, I don't think I need to remind the court that small pieces of crack cocaine get people in federal court sent away for long periods of time. I don't think it was that insignificant a situation in Jeffries. Judge Elrod, you mentioned common sense, and I do think there's a place for common sense in this case. I also think that the commission has done some of the heavy lifting. I would point out, I agree with Ms. Watson, and I think it is a matter of common sense that body armor is defensive. It is a defensive tool, if you will. My own experience with body armor during the war is I did not feel like Iron Man or Tron when I put body armor on or when members of my crew did. If we're going to speak about common sense and real-world understandings of it, I don't think that it necessarily emboldens people to go out on sprees. Could one imagine a circumstance in which that occurs? Yes. But that's precisely why the commission in the 2006 amendment narrowed the application. What cannot be, I think, ignored here is that the 2006 amendment had the effect of saying to those circuits which had broad interpretations of the application, no, we're not going to go as broadly. And I appreciate Ms. Watson's candor when saying, if the court goes with a more narrow interpretation, then it gets worse for the government the more narrow it gets. But the problem the government has is that's precisely what the commission did in 2006. It did narrow the interpretation. And that's precisely to take cases out of the universe of what's possible in terms of emboldenment or in terms of potentials, and instead to look at what actually facilitates. Ms. Watson says that 2K2.6 has no place in the argument. I'll repeat what I said earlier. We have the same conduct. The commission has said more times than I can shake a stick that sentencing courts are to look at the underlying conduct. There's not supposed to be playing around with counts. We're not supposed to have charge bargaining to avoid the application of the guidelines. And what I think implicitly the government is saying is, oh, yes, you will in a case like this, because we're arguing for an interpretation of the same facts that allows for a four-level enhancement, even though the commission has explained that the enhancement should apply for more narrowly. I think that's an interesting position to put the panel in. It's certainly not one that I would put the panel in. I think that the only way to read 2K2.6 and 2K2.1 pari materia is to remand the case with instruction and articulation to the district court and as a service to the bar to talk about the fact that the 2006 amendment had the narrowing effect. I don't think that's remarkable. I think it's fairly subtle in the law, but I think it escaped the district court's attention in this particular case, and to allow for resentencing. The panel doesn't have any more questions. I'll surrender my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Beer and Ms. Watson.